you have the power of impeachment, and it should not be feared, because far from being a constitutional crisis, when you impeach and remove an errant leader, a law-breaking leader, you are actually addressing the constitutional crisis.
That's John Nichols, and this is Writer's Voice, where the conversation goes deeper. We talk to writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. Welcome to the show. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Later on, we'll hear poet and author Richard Michelson read from his wonderful new book for children, Across the Alley. And we'll also give some information about events and readings that Michelson is doing in the coming weeks in our area. But first, now that the recent election has swung the Congress to Democratic control, the question of whether to impeach our current president and vice president has been getting more attention. Amherst, Massachusetts was the latest city to pass a resolution for impeachment. That happened in the town meeting on November 1st of this year. But would impeachment, as some say, merely distract the country from more pressing issues, such as the war in Iraq? Or would the process of impeachment restore accountability to an executive that many fear has become too powerful for the good of the republic? My guest, John Nichols, is Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine. His new book, The Genius of Impeachment, The Founder's Cure for Royalism, has won praise from Gore Vidal, Studs Terkel, and Howard Zinn for its well-researched exposition of why the founders of our country included the power to impeach in our Constitution. It's also been embraced by activists for its guidance on how to use this most ingenious tool for holding our elected officials accountable. Well, John Nichols, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's a great pleasure to be on with you, Francesca.
Your book, The Genius of Impeachment, is a cogent exposition of how impeachment is meant to be a tool for preserving democracy against what you call the imperial presidency. You know, it really seemed to be a tract in the tradition and the spirit of Tom Paine to me.
That's a very big compliment for those of us who see Paine as the greatest of our revolutionaries.
Yeah, could you say more about that? Do you see a connection between your work and his?
Absolutely, but I have to be very cautious about that because certainly we're in very different places, and my reverence for his genius causes me to be a bit embarrassed when I suggest comparisons. But I like to think that I write in his tradition. And the thing to understand about Tom Paine is that more than any of the other revolutionary leaders at the founding of this country, and we should all remember that America was founded as a revolutionary state in revolt against monarchy and the divine right of kings, is that Paine was a true revolutionary and a visionary. He was a man of the Enlightenment, like many of the other leaders, certainly Jefferson, Madison, George Mason. But at the same time, he was a man who recognized the limits even of the Enlightenment. He recognized that as people began to explore their full potential as human beings, that was very good, but they had to also respect the full potential of others. So it was Paine who was the strongest in his opposition to slavery. It was Paine who was the strongest in his sympathy for the rights of the economically depressed. He wasn't perfect. He made some mistakes on a number of issues. He wasn't strong enough on the rights of women. But his writing inspired others, like Mary Wollstonecraft, to take up the case of women with her vindication of the rights of women. And intriguingly enough, when that happened, far from being resentful or upset, Paine accepted the critique and then included women in his vision for all who should participate in democracy. So I see him as a very important touchstone, a very important reference point. And it's especially true in the circumstance of this time and of the issues I'm writing about, because Paine recognized that real change, fundamental change, will never come from presidents or even members of Congress. Real change, fundamental change, must always be rooted in the people. It will rise up from the grassroots. And I think that when we talk about an issue like impeachment, it is vital to understand that impeachment never works when it comes from the top down. We saw that in 1998 with Bill Clinton and the Republican Congress. It invariably works and is often a very successful tool for constraining the presidency when it comes from the grassroots up. One of the things that's so important to understand about the Constitution is that it is essentially a document for empowering citizens. And that's really not taught well enough in our schools and certainly not communicated at all well in our media. The founders, for instance, in the Constitution, made no reference to God. They made no reference to corporations or business arrangements. They made no reference to a two-party system or most of the processes by which we choose our leaders. But they made six references to impeachment. They were absolutely desperate that the people understand they had the power to remove their leaders whenever those leaders violated the law, were in contravention of the Constitution, or otherwise were inappropriate. And the reason for that passion, that focus, is because when the Constitution of the United States was being written, the people who were involved in the process were only 6 years away from open warfare against the British king. They knew how hard it was for the people to remove an errant or inappropriate or vile leader, and they wanted to make sure that the citizens of this country knew from their founding document that this power belonged to them.
Yeah, you know, sometimes it certainly seemed in reading your book that they had an incredibly prescient understanding of the process by which power could corrupt. Is that because of, does that simply just flow out of their experience with the monarchy per se, or do you think there was something else going on, something more extraordinary?
I think it's a combination, but I do think you're right in posing the question the way you do. Certainly at the root of it, there was a consciousness of the experience they had just been through. They had fought a battle that was epic in its nature, that took a very long time. You know, we talk about the Vietnam War, for instance, being a very long war, the potential that the current Iraq War will be a very long war. Remember, the American Revolution had its first battles really in the early 1770s, and it went on until the mid-1780s. So it was a very long, very bitter, very painful struggle, which a lot of Americans were killed, and also in which at many points it appeared that the Americans would not prevail. But all that is secondary to the fact of the ideas that underpinned that struggle. The American Revolution was a revolt against the divine right of kings. And people need to understand that term. The divine right of kings suggested that God had chosen the rulers of particular countries, regions of the world. And so if you revolted against the divine right of kings, you were not merely revolting against the individual occupant of an office. You were suggesting that this whole concept that God chose leaders, that there was an elite that would govern the citizenry, was false. And that was an amazing revolutionary idea at the time, one that many people feared in their hearts and souls. And so to have fought a revolution based on that idea and then to seek to create a nation based on that idea was a very energizing and enlivening activity. And so I think the founders were about something much more than just, you know, changing a particular leader or getting rid of a particular system of government. What they were saying was that, no, leaders were not chosen by God, and leaders are not chosen because they are members of an elite or of a particular family or because they have a particular wealth or they are a particular color or gender or sexuality. Leaders are chosen by the people, ideally based on their skills and on their good intentions. And should leaders fail in their positions of authority, they should not be treated like gods or kings or elites or special individuals. They should be seen as easily dispensed with. If a leader goes wrong, you get rid of that leader, and you don't have to wait till the next election. You have the power of impeachment, and as the founders said again and again, it should be used very aggressively, very quickly, and without hesitation. It should not be feared, because far from being a constitutional crisis, when you impeach and remove an errant leader, a law-breaking leader, you are actually addressing the constitutional crisis.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, my guest is John Nichols, and we're talking about the genius of impeachment, the founder's cure for royalism. So you're saying impeachment is the remedy, not the condition, but you mentioned the divine right of kings, and you also talk about the imperial presidency. I wonder if you could kind of connect the dots between these two. I mean, impeachment was brought about to ensure that we don't have kings. We haven't had kings for a long time, but we've used impeachment a lot more, as you point out in your book, than probably most of us realize.
Oh, yeah. from the founding of the country, there was an understanding that we needed to have tools to remove officials, be they appointed or elected, who acted inappropriately in violation of the Constitution, in violation of the laws, but also in ways that might be damaging to the democratic experiment in the republic. And so there have been more than 60 impeachments throughout the history of the country, judges, cabinet members, and others. 9 presidents of the United States have been the targets of impeachment efforts, starting in the 1840s with John Tyler. And the thing to understand about impeachment is that it's been fetishized in recent years. People tend to look at it now as something, you know, very dangerous and almost draconian. But at the founding of the country and in the early years of the country, there was a much greater understanding of the importance of, you know, keeping presidents in their place and keeping high officials in their place, for lack of a better term. Famously, when Thomas Jefferson was elected president in 1800, in really the critical defining election of the American experiment, he beat John Adams, who was much more of a royalist. Jefferson rode on horseback alone from his plantation in Virginia to Washington, and he checked into a rooming house on the night before he was to be sworn in. The woman who ran the rooming house offered him, as was common in those days, offered him a place closest to the fire. The most elite or prominent of the guests in a rooming house was given the warmest and most pleasant place to sit. And Jefferson refused it. He said, no, I'm the last person to check in, so I should, by tradition, sit the farthest from the fire, and I should be treated no better than anyone else at the table, no better than any of these traveling folks who've checked into this rooming house. And so that was accepted. He had his dinner. The next morning he went and was sworn in as president. He walked back alone through the muddy streets of Washington to the rooming house. There was no White House at that time. Sat down at the end of the table, and the woman said, surely, Mr. Jefferson, now that you've been made the president of the United States, you must take the place of honor by the fire. Jefferson corrected her and said, no, I'm actually one rung below where I was yesterday. Yesterday, I sat with you as a citizen. Today, I sit with you as your servant.
What a wonderful story. It's hard to imagine, however, that that would be the way a president might act today.
I can't see George Bush doing that, eh?
No, nor even Bill Clinton in a very real sense. You said before that impeachment has been seen in recent years as something exceedingly serious. And in the book, it seems, if I'm correct, that you connect that to the impeachment of Bill Clinton. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
I think it's connected to the impeachment of Bill Clinton and also to the impeachment of Richard Nixon. And what I think has happened with impeachment is not that impeachment has changed. And remember, impeachment can always be abused. It can always be used in inappropriate ways, like any tool of government. Remember, elections can be abused and used in inappropriate ways. So impeachment itself hasn't changed that much. What has changed is our image of the presidency. And we have made the presidency dramatically more powerful than it has ever been in the history of the country in the last, you know, 30 to 40 years. Arthur Schlesinger Jr., the historian, makes reference to what he refers to as the imperial presidency. The notion that this office, which was once seen as that of a servant to the people and really was kept in a relatively constrained position for most of the nation's history, has changed radically. Remember that when Franklin Roosevelt was president, President Roosevelt opened his office to reporters. They came in and stood around his desk, and they would wander in and talk to him. Ordinary citizens had tremendous access to the president, and the president felt that was the appropriate thing. Now, Roosevelt was very powerful and, you know, in many ways considered to be a very authoritarian president. And yet, if we look back at how Roosevelt managed his presidency, about the number of positions he was able to appoint, about the role that he saw for himself as president, it is so constrained, so limited compared to what the presidency is today, that it's unimaginable. Today, we have a presidency where the president appoints thousands of people to positions of authority, where the president has the ability to launch wars without a declaration from Congress and does so on a regular basis. We have not in this country declared war on another country since 1941. Yet we've been in tons of wars.
That's right. In fact, I think we've been in war on a pretty consistent basis.
Yeah, but see, this is what's changed. You know, all of the rules, all of the infrastructure that constrained the presidency, of which impeachment is a part, have really been undermined. And so we've come over time to slowly accept a presidency that is so much more powerful, so much more authoritarian than the founders imagined, and then for most of the history of the country we had. George Bush has signed hundreds of signing statements which say that he does not have to obey the laws passed by Congress that he is signing into law. He says, well, I'm going to sign this into law because that's my duty as president, but I'm not going to obey it. George Bush has launched illegal, warrantless wiretapping on the American people in absolute contravention not merely of the FISA Act, the Intelligence Surveillance Act, but also the Constitution itself, the Fourth Amendment. George Bush has engaged us in two undeclared wars at this time. And, you know, we go on down the list. And, you know, you can hate Bush, as many people do, but I think that's a misread of the situation. I think Bush is using powers that he believes, and frankly that a lot of people in Washington believe, are associated with the presidency. And the reason I argue that we have to take impeachment seriously is because if we allow George Bush to finish this presidency, having established that these are the powers of the chief executive of the country, the next president, be that president a Democrat or Republican, liberal, conservative, will assume those same powers and extend them even further.
The book is The Genius of Impeachment, and my guest is author John Nichols. Now, you point out that this didn't start with George Bush, that he built on the shoulders of the previous president, Bill Clinton. And did Bill Clinton also stand on the shoulders of those before
him? Without a doubt. And I think really the critical breaking point in the last quarter century came about 20 years ago with the Iran-Contra scandal of the 1980s. The Iran-Contra scandal, which I focus on a lot in the book, it was a scandal in which we found out that the president's aides and allies had engaged in activities that directly and specifically violated a law passed by the Congress of the United States. Congress said that you couldn't fund the Contras who were fighting to overthrow the government in Nicaragua. And so that law was violated by people within the White House. Then we found out that they violated a whole bunch of other laws, that they were trading with countries they weren't supposed to trade with, that they were doing all sorts of secret things. And it was just a complete array of incredible, almost mind-boggling lawlessness. And when that occurred, one member of Congress, Henry B. Gonzalez, a congressman from the barrio of San Antonio in Texas, said, you know, we have to impeach Ronald Reagan and Vice President George Herbert Walker Bush for these actions, because if we don't, then we will essentially be sanctioning these actions. We'll essentially be saying we accept that this is what a president can do. Well, Democrats in Congress didn't choose that route. They instead set up a couple of commissions and inquiries, and basically they gave Reagan and Bush a firm slap on the wrist and let them carry on, let them finish their terms. Well, I would suggest that Henry B. Gonzalez has been proven exactly right, that because no serious sanction was placed upon Reagan and Bush back in 1987, we, as a country, accepted that a president can act in direct violation of the laws of the land, including laws passed by the Congress in recent years, also in direct violation of the Constitution, and get away with it. This circumstance is going to continue. It's going to get worse because, as you say, presidents build on the actions of previous presidents. And so what I would argue is the folks in your area, folks in Amherst, who recently passed a local resolution calling for impeachment, are doing exactly what must be done, because if we don't intervene at this point and say, after a period of what clearly appears to be extreme lawlessness in the Oval Office and the executive branch, we will look back 20 years from now and say, man, did we make a mistake there? Just as I think many people in Washington look back at what happened with Iran-Contra and now recognize that Henry B. Gonzalez was right.
But haven't there been times where the tide of imperial power of the presidency versus the power of other branches of government have ebbed and flowed? I mean, I'm thinking, for example, of President Wilson during World War I, even FDR, who, after all, did suspend habeas corpus and did that as commander-in-chief of the Army. So what do you think makes this difference? I mean, isn't this something that could possibly just go away on its own, or what's different about now?
Well, I think that Frederick Douglass is right, that power never concedes without a demand. And so you're right that the authority of the White House, the authority of the presidency and the executive branch, has ebbed and flowed through history. But it has ebbed and flowed because people have challenged it, because people stood up and said, you know, we're not going to let this continue. The thought that it just happens naturally is wrong. when the presidency is constrained, either by election, particularly of a very strong opposition Congress, or by actions such as impeachment or censure, and we've seen these many times through history, that's when we begin to restore some of the balance. Where things get really out of balance and we edge toward a much more dangerous circumstance are those moments when we don't respond, either as citizens or as elected officials and representatives of the citizens in Congress. And that's my fear about the current moment. I don't necessarily think that this is the most dire circumstance in the history of the country. When I look back across the history of the United States, I see some incredibly dark, incredibly difficult moments. Certainly the eve of the Civil War in 1860 is one example of that, and also the circumstance that we were in the early 1930s with the Great Depression is another one. But when we get out of sync as a country, when we become dysfunctional, particularly in our governance, if citizens don't rise up and say, hey, we've got to do something about this, and if members of Congress do not respond to that outcry, then we lock in our degeneration. You know, the place that we've fallen to, the dysfunction that we've entered into, becomes the established pattern of the country. And generally, we don't evolve upward from that. We devolve downward. And so I think that's why this is a critical moment. We have a choice to make. And we also have the authority now with the change in control of Congress to begin to seriously investigate the actions of this administration. And should those investigations lead to the point where I think many of us believe they will, then to officially sanction the administration. There are many, many vehicles to do this. Senator Russ Feingold has proposed the censure of the president for illegal warrantless wiretapping. A number of members of the House have, over the last few years, talked about impeachment, although it's been tamped down recently, I think, because Democrats are very cautious about the use of the word. But I do believe that ultimately this moment that we're in, is the one where we will decide not what happens to George Bush and Dick Cheney, but what kind of country we're going to have for the next 10, 20, 30 years or longer.
Talk about the change in the, certainly in the power of the House. I guess you could say that we might be moving. Hopefully we've moved from a one-party state back to a two-party state. But Nancy Pelosi, almost the first thing she said after the election was that impeachment is off the table. And I want you to comment on that, but I'd also wonder if you could put it within the context of war, because this is something that seems to be paired quite a bit with the history of impeachment in this country and even in the minds of the founders.
Absolutely. Well, two very different questions, and let me try and address them both. First off, Nancy Pelosi's statement that impeachment is off the table, and that is a rather typical statement for the leader of an opposition party when it comes into control of Congress or when it's in control of Congress. Remember that back in 1973, when many of the details of the Watergate scandal were becoming clear, when Woodward and Bernstein were reporting for the Washington Post about all sorts of violations of the law, Carl Albert, who was the Speaker of the House, was asked whether he thought that Nixon was going to be impeached. He said, absolutely not. We're not going to go there. Tip O'Neill, who eventually became a key player in the impeachment in 1973, was saying, oh, we're not going to do that. That's crazy. That's just not going to happen. So the Speaker of the House and leaders of the opposition party invariably will tell you that impeachment is off the table. And that's actually natural. It's nothing to be particularly concerned about, because impeachment is an organic process. It is the combination of investigations and inquiries that reveal information about wrongdoing with the outcry of the people, and that always drives the political class in the right direction. When you lack that combination, impeachment never works. It's never effective. And so I don't particularly worry much about what Pelosi's saying or where it's at, because, frankly, she's a peripheral player to this. She's a secondary player. The key players really are those members of Congress who head investigatory committees, like Henry Waxman at House Government Reform, Russ Feingold in the Senate, who's going to take over the Constitution Subcommittee of Judiciary. We have a lot of power, a lot of authority to look into the president's wrongdoing and plan to do so. And so that's one key player. And the other key players are the people themselves. Again, like the folks in Amherst who recently passed a resolution, and folks across the country who are involved in things of this nature. In Vermont next March, town meetings across the state are going to take up impeachment resolutions, as some of them did earlier this year. So in the overall scheme of things, I think we're actually on a pretty normal track as regards the discussion of impeachment at this point in a presidency. Now, the second thing you brought up was war, in the context of a time of war. And I write about that a great deal in the book, because that's really one of the myths that needs to be undone. There's a sense that in a time of war, you can't really challenge the president, that this is a time when it's not appropriate to raise questions about the legitimacy of the president or the legitimacy of his or her actions. In fact, the founders intended the exact opposite. It makes sense when you think about it that the time when you would talk about impeaching a president would be when that president has committed an act that really does endanger the country, when the president has sent our sons and daughters into harm's way for illegitimate or even illegal reasons, when our liberties are certainly under attack. And Jefferson, Madison, George Mason, the other founders, wrote about this at great length. Madison believed that, in his words, war is the true wet nurse of executive aggrandizement, that a nation cannot long remain free in a time of perpetual warfare, something like, you know, what Bush has suggested we are in with the war on terror. Jefferson said that war had the potential to make a president, quote, a king for 4 years, and perhaps even longer if he should extend his powers. So the founders were very, very conscious that it was in a time of war that the people and that the Congress were most required to look at the option of impeachment should a president commit illegal or immoral acts. And this was well understood for the early years of the Republic. In the 1840s, there's a wonderful story about James K. Polk led the country into what was clearly an illegal war and an imperialist war with Mexico, a war that seized much of what is now the southwestern United States from Mexico. There was a young congressman who came out to Washington, elected in 1846 on an anti-war platform, who sought to censure the president, and then with an older congressman began to raise questions of impeaching President Polk for engaging in this war without a legitimate reason for going to war and using it as a tool to annex new territory, which would become slave states. And both of these, this young congressman was particularly opposed to slavery. During the course of this, his efforts to sanction the president, he got a letter from his law partner back at home who said, you know, you just can't do this. We're in a time of war. The troops are in battle. You can't question the president. He's the commander-in-chief. You can't take him out. The young congressman wrote back this exquisite letter in which he said, you know, look, no, that's exactly wrong. The reason the Constitution was written in the way it was, with the checks and balances, with the separation of powers, with tools such as impeachment, was because the founders knew that kings had always been involving countries in unnecessary wars, and that those wars were the tool by which kings extended their power. And so he said, yes, we're going to continue to try and sanction and undermine this presidency, because if we fail to do so, we will place the presidency where kings have always stood. A direct quote there. And, of course, the young congressman signed, sincerely, Abraham Lincoln.
That's great. You know, my mother called me, my 86-year-old mother called me after the election to celebrate with me.
Yes, I understand.
And she said, though, now if we could only now impeach Bush, but that wouldn't work because then we'd have Cheney as president.
Ah, this is the question I get. I've been touring around the country, and it's been a wonderful tour, going to bookstores and events all over, book festivals and things all over the country, and we've had great crowds and very rollicking, fun events, because I think the discussion of impeachment is actually something that's very fun and energizing. But we always get that question. Somebody always stands up and says, oh, yeah, but, you know, what about Cheney? Well, the answer to that is twofold. First, if you read the Constitution, it makes specific reference to impeachment of presidents and vice presidents. There's no reason that you cannot have parallel tracks for examination of the impeachment of the president and the vice president. In fact, one of the things that's lost to history, forgotten about the Watergate era, was that we had that occurring then. There were people who were beginning to propose the impeachment of Richard Nixon in 1973 at the same time that there were people beginning to propose the impeachment of then-Vice President Spiro Agnew. Now, Agnew stepped down, and ultimately Nixon did as well. But there's no reason why you can't sanction or hold to account the whole of an administration. That is not inappropriate. Even if we don't do that, however, remember that impeachment is not about the man. It is about the office. It is about cleansing the presidency and putting on it the sanctions and the controls that are necessary. And so we shouldn't fear the impeachment of George Bush because of who might come into power after George Bush. If we constrain the presidency, if we make it clear that the occupant of the Oval Office does not have the sweeping powers that President Bush has assumed, we change the character of the position, And we make it impossible, or certainly dramatically less likely, for whoever occupies it to abuse it in the way that, that Bush and Cheney have. And so I don't really worry about who comes after George Bush. What I worry about is that we as a people, as a country, say, no, we do not want this kind of presidency. I will tell you one other thing, too. Nobody's ever actually fully impeached. Nobody's taken to the full end of the process. What happens is politicians resign. They always do. They either decide not to seek re-election or they quit office. That's just how they respond, because they don't want to actually be dragged out of the White House in chains. And so at the end of the day, I think if impeachment were to rise to a serious initiative, and I do believe that the investigations that will occur in Congress after Democrats take charge in January could well bring us to that point. My suspicion is that Cheney would very quickly resign, and I think he is actually in many ways the most logical target of an impeachment inquiry. His actions in a number of senses are more egregious than George Bush's. And should he resign, then, of course, the House and Senate choose a successor. And because we have a Democratic House and Senate at this point...
That would be Nancy Pelosi.
Well, it wouldn't have to be. No, it could be. You know, remember, if Cheney resigns, they get to choose a new vice president. But that new vice president would almost certainly be a compromise choice and somebody who is relatively honorable. And then once that's done, then we can proceed with the impeachment of Bush.
My guest is John Nichols, political correspondent for The Nation magazine. We're talking about his latest book, The Genius of Impeachment, The Founder's Cure for Royalty. There's more of our conversation with Nichols after the break. And Richard Michelson reads a selection from his latest book for children, Across the Alley. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and this is Writer's Voice. Stay with us.
If not us, not them. If not now, then when? If not here, nor there. If not this world, then where? If not us, not them. If not now, then when? If not here, nor there. If not this world, then where? If not us, not them. If not now, then when? If not here, nor there. If not this world, then where?
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. Now back to John Nichols on the genius of impeachment.
Impeachment is valuable because it is a tool by which we change the nature of the presidency, where we bring it back into, you know, a system of checks and balances. Once we've done that, whoever occupies it, Democrat, Republican, liberal, conservative, will have far less ability to do harm to not just America and the world, but also to the democratic experiment itself.
And you call that the genius of impeachment.
I do. As a matter of fact, I think impeachment is an incredibly ingenious, incredibly creative tool. The founders, they didn't invent it. It came from Britain. In fact, it has roots going back to Scotland in the 13th century. But the way that they laid it out in the Constitution, and if you read their writings, the way that they clearly intended for it to be used was ingenious. It was a way of taking us away from the personalities and causing us to worry much more about the structures of government and about the powers and the authority of particular offices. And if a president assumes that he or she can do things that are clearly in contravention of the Constitution, that are clearly inappropriate, dangerous, foolhardy, we have the ability to cleanse the office of that, to say, no, that's not what the president is allowed to do. You've violated the rules. You've gone too far. We're going to remove you. But we're also saying to all future occupants of the office, you can't do that sort of thing.
I wanted to also ask you, you mentioned Amherst and also Newfane, Vermont.
Yes.
Just tell us very briefly what's happened there and what people can do who are listening to this show, what they can do to find out more about impeachment if they want to become involved with it.
Absolutely. Impeachment is in play. It's happening because, as I said before, it's an organic process. It comes from below, from the people, telling their members of Congress that they must act. And we have now seen more than 24 communities across the country, places as small as, you know, little towns like Newfane up in Vermont, all the way up to San Francisco, one of the largest and most famous cities in the world that have passed resolutions either through referendums or through official actions of their local government calling on Congress to impeach President Bush and Vice President Cheney. Amherst just did so on November 1st, the most recent community to do so by action of a town meeting. San Francisco and Urbana, Illinois did so in the November 7th election by overwhelming margins. Up in Vermont, where really in many senses this process started, with a guy named Dan DeWalt, who's a town selectman in Newfane, it's going gangbusters. A number of towns across southern Vermont have already implemented impeachment resolutions. Brattleboro is the largest of them. And next spring, in March, at the town meetings across Vermont, you'll see, I think, dozens, perhaps hundreds of communities that take up impeachment resolutions.
And this is more than just symbolic, you say. This is actually something that can then affect the legislature, the state legislature, and from there go to the Congress.
Absolutely. In fact, there is, in the book I go into this, I won't go into great detail here, but Jefferson fully intended the possibility that a state legislature could assert an article of impeachment, send it to Congress, and urge Congress to act upon it. And that option still exists. I think the Vermont legislature is exploring it very seriously. But beyond that, I think that when communities take these actions, they influence their elected representatives. When the towns of Vermont voted for impeachment resolutions in the spring of 2006, Congressman Bernie Sanders, the representative from Vermont, had initially said that he really wasn't that interested in impeachment. He wasn't interested in going that direction and had sort of refrained from engaging with it. But after all these towns passed the resolutions, a day later, he sent out a press release saying that he was going to sign on to a proposal by Congressman John Conyers to set up a committee to investigate whether articles of impeachment should be brought against the president. So I think that there's that direct connection. When people act at the grassroots level, they, A, influence their elected members of Congress, but, B, they also begin a process that might see state legislative action and then articles of impeachment going up that way. And you asked how people can get involved, how they can get engaged. There's a website called afterdowningstreet.org. Again, that's afterdowningstreet.org. And if people go to that, they can find a tremendous amount of information about impeachment efforts and different things that are going on. There's also a group called Progressive Democrats of America that has been very, very involved in this, and people can go online and find those connections as well. And remember, there really are a lot of folks in Western Massachusetts who've been in the forefront of seeking to hold this administration to account. I would remind folks that I believe it's in Northampton, the Bill of Rights Defense Committee
That's
is headquartered.
Right. That's right.
And those folks are, you know, in my opinion, the Tom Paines, the Paul Revere's of our time. They have done incredible work on challenging the Patriot Act and challenging presidential and executive branch illegality. And so I think, you know, it's safe to say that Western Massachusetts is a hotbed of small-D democratic patriotism. And I genuinely believe that addressing these issues, holding officials to account, is the ultimate patriotism. It's the fundamental patriotism. And perhaps because Western Massachusetts is a very long history of being a place where patriots gather, there's a better understanding than in some parts of the country. But I will remind you that the Bill of Rights Defense Committee has found that as they raise these issues of presidential accountability and respect for the Constitution, they get support from all across the country.
That's right. Well, we've been at it since Shay's Rebellion.
That's right. And as my friend, the guy who wrote the introduction to the book, is kind of a young writer who's trying to make his way into business, and I kind of thought I'd give him a break, Gore Vidal.
Oh, yeah.
But of course, Gore wrote probably one of the greatest essays in American history, which was Homage to Daniel Shays. In my opinion, it's one of the greatest essays ever written about the American experiment. And Gore, by the way, has been very much in the forefront of supporting impeachment. He just recently cut a soundbite, a little statement on impeachment, which if people go to the After Downing Street site, they can actually, you know, if you've got the right computer equipment, you can listen to.
Well, we're going to link to all those websites that you mentioned on our website. And also, we actually interviewed John Boniface of afterdowningstreet.org here. So there is.
And John is a hero of my book. So he's referencing it quite often. So, one of the things that we often forget to do as citizens is to kind of read up on our country, you know, not just the history of it, but how it works, how it's supposed to work. And when we do that, we're often shocked to learn how much power we really have and how much authority we really should have as citizens, as participants in this process. And so what I would recommend to people is that they, you know, read widely, take in information, and engage with this process. I think what they'll find is that, A, impeachment is far less frightening than they thought, and B, that the hope for redeeming the republic is actually far more alive than most of our media or most of our political class would tell folks.
Well, that's a very hopeful note to end on. So thanks so much, John Nichols, for writing this wonderful book. It's also very eloquently written. It's a terrific read in itself. The Genius of Impeachment, The Founder's Cure for Royalism.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's a delight to spend time talking about this subject, and also to be talking to folks in a region of the country that really has taken the lead on this issue. It's a pleasure talking to you. I really like your style. I enjoy the seriousness with which you do this. And it was funny because as we were talking about, you know, the show's called Writer's Voice. I didn't know how much you were going to ask me about, you know, just the process of writing, which we didn't too much. But, you know, I was sort of excited by that prospect because, you know, when you write about politics as opposed to doing novels or doing more literary work, people rarely ask you about writing.
Yeah. So about the writing of this book, the style of it is very particular. You know, there's a lot of research that's done in it, but also the kind of eloquence of it. So I wonder if you could talk about those issues.
One of the things that I recognized when I set out to write this book is that it was really a counterintuitive book. It was a book that challenged a lot of ways of thinking in contemporary America, because we have so many myths and cliches as regards impeachment that I wanted to sort of, you know, take this tool, you know, out of its muck and mire of mythology and sort of restore it to what the founders intended. And to do that, I had to first, as you point out, do an immense amount of research and try and figure out for myself what it was and what the founders intended. But also I had to find a way to talk about it and to put it into perspective. And that was, to me, the great pleasure of writing this book, which is to try and reconnect with the idealism and the passion of the founders and of those who've respected impeachment throughout history. One of the reviewers, a very nice review from Mother Jones, said that, you know, said something like, Nichols is an unabashed democratic idealist. And I thought, well, you know, that, to me, that's exactly, that reviewer got the point of what I was seeking to do. Because I wanted to leap over the way that most of media talks about politics, talks about government, certainly talks about the Constitution, and get into the way that people at their best talk about it, and to try and spark that excitement that folks can find when they really are empowered, when they really do think they're a part of the process. And so one of the things that I did was reread a lot of the other pamphleteers from the founding of the country, because I wanted to capture a bit of their style, to write in that birthing sense, for lack of a better term, the notion that you know, we really do have the power to change the course of the world, that we really do have the power to begin the world anew, as Paine suggested. And so I wanted to have an element of that style and that enthusiasm, that passion, which I think is missing from most of our writing today. I think most political books in America today are written by political insiders for other political insiders. I wanted this to be a book written by maybe somebody who does cover a lot of politics, and I do that for a living, but who wants to talk to real people and folks across this country in a much more open and hopefully impassioned manner than most of our political class and certainly most of our media is willing to do. So, I think the writing style is maybe one of the most important things about the book. It may actually be more important than any specific fact.
Yeah, and, you know, it's not just the eloquence and the passion. It's them in combination with the lucidity that really reminded me of Tom Paine. And it was a very exciting book to read.
You know, that's obviously you can't say anything more complimentary to a writer than that. You know, but I've heard this from other folks. In fact, we've had a wonderful, kind of fascinating thing happen. A group of women over in Ithaca, New York, you know, one of them got a hold of a copy of the book, and they got kind of excited about it, and they shared it with one another. And they decided that they wanted to send a copy of the book to every member of the House and Senate with a personal note saying, you know, we hope that you'll read this. not because we're telling you you must impeach Bush today or tomorrow, but because we really want you to become reacquainted with a better way of thinking about your power and your authority as members of Congress. And amazingly enough, in a remarkably short amount of time, they raised the money to do it.
Wow.
I think they're just finishing the process right now. And then they're going to have a party where they all get together and they're going to package up the books and send them off to members of Congress.
Well, what a great story, and let's hope that it has the desired effect.
I totally do, and I really believe that in a sense it already has had the desired effect, because when citizens get engaged at that level, it's true, many members of Congress still won't pay attention, but a few will, I guarantee you. Politicians come in many different flavors and forms, and there are plenty who fit all of the cliched and predictable descriptions. But there are still those of two kinds that are important. One is those who, as Jefferson intended, fear the people. And remember, Jefferson said that the people should not fear their leaders. The leaders should fear the people. So that's an appropriate thing. That's not a bad thing. And then there's also the kind who, for lack of a better term, love the people, who actually do believe that the genius of this American experiment, of this great long American journey, is that some of the best ideas ultimately do come from the grassroots, from real people living in small towns across this country. And so I think that this project that this lovely woman in Ithaca, New York, and some of her friends have initiated is one example of that genius, of that wisdom, of the people sort of welling up. And if they reach even a handful of members of Congress and actually convince them to pay attention to these issues, whether they read my book or somebody else's, or just start to talk with folks about the issue, they will have had perhaps a more profound impact on the Republic than, you know, most of our great media commentators or pundits.
Well, John Nichols, thanks again for talking with us. It's been really terrific.
Great pleasure.
We've been talking with John Nichols, the nation's Washington correspondent, about his book, The Genius of Impeachment, The Founder's Cure for Royalism. And we have links to the websites mentioned by Nichols, like afterdowningstreet.org, Progressive Democrats of America, and the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, up on our website at www.writersvoice.net. My next guest, Richard Michelson, is well known in our local area for his art galleries in Northampton and Amherst, Massachusetts. But he's also a poet and an author of books for children. We recorded an interview earlier in the week with him, which will air on December 22nd. But I thought it would be a good idea to play an excerpt from that interview for you now. Michelson has written several books for children, including, among others, Too Young for Yiddish and Happy Feet, which isn't about a dancing penguin, but about a boy, his father, and the 1926 opening of the Savoy Ballroom in Harlem. His latest book, Across the Alley, also takes place in New York City, in Brooklyn. It's sumptuously illustrated by E.B. Lewis and published by Putnam, and it would make a great gift for some child this holiday season. I asked Michelson to say something about the book and then to read from it. The next book that I would like us to talk about, Across the Alley, which mm-hmm. is your newest, the setting is Brooklyn. And my son, by the way, lives in Bedford-Stuyvesant, which mm-hmm. is a predominantly African-American neighborhood, right on the edge of a Hasidic community.
Yeah.
So talk about that Brooklyn community of Across the Alley.
I grew up in a time when first, certainly, there was racial tension. But as I grew older, Jews and blacks tended to be natural allies. I grew up assuming that the same picket lines would have Jews and blacks, and they were generally fighting for the same things. Very hard for me to understand today how Jews and blacks tend to be on the opposite side of many issues and not consider themselves natural allies. I hope through this book to give young people a sense of a time when that wasn't always so, when we could cross those lines. But certainly they were difficult lines to cross, and tension exists, always exists. The book doesn't sugarcoat that. The children's father and grandfather do not want them to play together. Generally, the book is about two children who are told that they should stay clear of each other, but their bedroom windows face each other, and at night they develop a friendship through those windows.
Okay, so let's give our listeners a taste of Across the Alley. I'd like you to read a good portion of the book, and why don't we just start at the beginning, and we'll go about two-thirds of the way through, and then we'll let you listeners find out on your own what happens in the story.
All right. Across the Alley. Every night after Grandpa turns out the light, I count to 20 before I tiptoe out of bed and tug open my shade. Across the alley, I know Willie's doing the same. During the day, we don't play together, but at night, when nobody's watching, Willie and I are best friends. Last winter, I watched his finger spell out "hi" through the frost on his bedroom window. He wrote each letter backwards and then waved. I heard the ice cracking as I jimmied open my pane. My daddy was a starter in the Negro Leagues, Willie told me, and he says someday I'm going to pitch in the majors. The next night, Willie showed me how to throw a real big league slider. He knew just where I should stretch my fingers across the stitches. When spring comes, I sit out on the stoop. Down the street, those other boys are always batting and having fun. I see a grounder run full steam through Willie's legs like a rat racing for the sewer. Then a pop-up drops out of Willie's glove. Now that it's summer, we open our windows wide and play catch. Most days, I'm Sandy Koufax and he's Satchel Paige. Some days we switch. Grandpa says Jewish kids shouldn't waste time with baseball. He thinks I should spend every minute practicing the violin. God gave you a brain, Abe, he says. Let those Negro boys play ball. After Grandpa gives me my lesson, I go to my room to practice. Willie leans out the window and asks if he can play. I tell him where to rest his chin on the chin rest and how much rosin to slide across the hairs of the bow. All summer long, I teach him everything I learned. Willie's as natural as Satchel on the mound. His fingers fly up and down the fingerboard like the pavement's too hot to set your bare feet on the ground. You'll be the next Yasha Heifetz, Grandpa says proudly one night when he comes to turn out the light. I think you're ready for the recital at the temple next Tuesday afternoon. My palms turn sweaty like I've been caught throwing a spitball. I want to tell him it was Willie, but I can't think of anything to say. Grandpa was a great violinist in the old country, I tell Willie late that night. But there was a war, and the Nazis broke all of his fingers and worked him like a slave. Grandpa says he was lucky to escape with his life. Willie's real quiet now, and I wonder if I said something wrong. Maybe he doesn't know about the Nazis. My great-granddaddy was a slave, too, Willie finally says. I never knew any white folk that were. Then we're both real quiet, until Willie decides that it's time we went to bed. All weekend, I stay in my room practicing. Willie tells his daddy he's sick, so he can stay in his room, too. I know Willie should be working on his windup. Tuesday, his daddy coaches baseball, and Willie's penciled in to do the pitching. I take a break to practice my own windup, so I pass my violin out the window to Willie. Soon, my arm's spinning like the Coney Island Ferris wheel, and his bow's kicking up so much breeze there's not a single fly left to swat in the city. We're both working so hard, I don't even hear Grandpa open my door. First, Grandpa looks at me, and then at Willie, and then he turns back towards me one more time. I'm holding my breath real tight. You'll be the next Yasha Heifetz, Grandpa finally says. And then he shows Willie the correct position of his bow.
Really wonderful story there. And the book is Across the Alley. It's the latest children's book written by my guest, Richard Michelson, and illustrated by E.B. Lewis. Well, that's it this week for Writer's Voice, airing on this station and podcasting on the web at writersvoice.net. Please send your comments about the show, suggestions for authors you'd like to hear, or anything else you'd like to tell us to write@writersvoice.net. Please join us next week for a how-to session for publishers and podcasters. We'll have a live interview with Peter Bowerman about his book, The Well-Fed Self-Publisher. You can find links to information about it on our website, so check it out. And if you have questions you'd like to ask or have us ask, email them by Thursday before the show to write@writersvoice.net. You can also call in during the show at 413-545-3691. Also, podcast pioneer Rob Walch of the website Podcast 411 will talk about his latest book, Tricks of the Podcasting Masters. So if you've wondered about this new medium or would like to improve your own podcast, be sure to tune in. Until next week, I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.